Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
We shall read from Bhagavad Gita as it is chapter 9. The most confidential knowledge. Text 14. Please repeat. Satatam
Satatam
Tirthayanta
Tirthayanta
Mam
Mam
Yatanta
Yatanta
Cha Dridha Vrata Namashyanta Cha Mam Bhaktya Nitya Yukta Upasate Satatam kirtayanto mam
Satatam kirtayanto mam
Yatantascha drida vrataha
Yatantascha drida vrataha
Namasyantascha mam bhaktya
Namasyantascha mam bhaktya
Nitya yukta upasate
Nitya yukta upasate
Satatam,
Satatam,
always,
always,
Kirtayanta,
Kirtayanta,
chanting,
chanting,
Mam,
Mam,
about me,
about me,
Yatanta,
Yatanta,
fully endeavoring,
fully endeavoring,
Cha,
Cha,
also,
also,
Dridhavritaha,
Dridhavritaha,
with determination.
With determination.
Namasyanta,
Namasyanta,
offering obeisances.
Offering obeisances.
Cha,
Cha,
and
Mam,
me.
Me.
Bhaktya,
Bhaktya,
in devotion.
Devotion.
Nitya yukta,
Nitya yukta,
perpetually engaged.
Perpetually engaged.
Upasate,
Upasate,
worship.
Worship.
Translation. Always chanting my glories, endeavoring with great determination, bowing down before me. These great souls perpetually worship me with devotion. Please repeat. Always chanting my glories.
Always chanting my glories.
Endeavoring with great determination.
Endeavoring with great determination.
Bowing down before me.
Bowing down before me.
These great souls.
These great souls.
Perpetually worship me.
Perpetually worship me.
With devotion.
With devotion.
Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The Mahatma cannot be manufactured by rubber stamping an ordinary man. His symptoms are described here. A Mahatma is always engaged in chanting the glories of the Supreme Lord Krishna, the Personality of Godhead. He has no other business. He is always engaged in the glorification of the Lord. In other words, he is not an impersonalist. When the question of glorification is there, one has to glorify the Supreme Lord, praising his holy name, his eternal form, his transcendental qualities, and his uncommon pastimes. One has to glorify all these things. Therefore, a Mahatma is attached to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. One who is attached to the impersonal feature of the Supreme Lord, the Brahma Jyoti, is not described as Mahatma in the Bhagavad Gita. He is described in a different way in the next verse. The Mahatma is always engaged in different activities of devotional service, as described in the Srimad Bhagavatam, hearing and chanting about Vishnu, not a demigod or human being. That is devotion. Shravanam Kirtanam Vishnu and Smaranam, remembering him. Such a Mahatma has firm determination to achieve at the ultimate end the association of the Supreme Lord in any one of the five transcendental rasas. To achieve that success, he engages all activities, mental, bodily, and vocal, everything, in the service of the Supreme Lord, Sri Krishna. That is called full Krishna consciousness. In devotional service, there are certain activities which are called determined, such as fasting on certain days, like the 11th day of the moon, Ekadasi, and on the appearance day of the Lord. All these rules and regulations are offered by the great acharyas for those who are actually interested in getting admission into the association of the Supreme Personality of Godhead in the transcendental world. The Mahatmas, great souls, strictly observe all these rules and regulations, and therefore they are sure to achieve the desired result. Translation again. Always chanting my glories, endeavoring with great determination, bowing down before me. These great souls perpetually worship me with devotion. Hare Krishna. There's more on the next page. Okay. As described in the second verse of this chapter, not only is this devotional service easy, but it can be performed in a happy mood. one does not need to undergo any severe penance and austerity. He can live this life in devotional service, guided by an expert spiritual master, and in any position, either as a householder or a sannyasi or a brahmachari, in any position and anywhere in the world, he can perform this devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead and thus become actually Mahatma, a great soul. Very good. Very important. So again, the verse, always chanting my glories, endeavoring with great determination, bowing down before me, these great souls perpetually worship me with devotion. So this verse not only describes the qualifications of a Mahatma, but it also tells us how we can become Mahatmas. The first, Yudhisthira Prabhu, I think let them keep the books. It's good if they keep the books in their hands. Yeah, you can just sit and listen. So, the first word, satatam, means always. And the last phrase is nitya, nitya yukta upasate, which also means always. In other words, we have to be engaged always in glorification of the Lord. It may be by directly chanting the holy names of the Lord or glorifying His transcendental qualities, beautiful form, uncommon pastimes. Or it may be accompanied by other types of service, such as archana, deity worship. Nine different types of devotional service. But the primary ones are Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, and Smaranam. Shravanam means hearing. Kirtanam means chanting, and Smaranam means remembering. Now, in order to have the determination to engage perpetually in the service of the Lord, one must understand who He is. Srimad Bhagavatam says, Nate vidu svartha gatim hi Vishnu. Everyone is interested in his or her self-interest. That is natural. Every single person in this room is here because he or she thinks they will get something out of it. Anything we do, whatever it is, we do it because we think we'll get something out of it. And that getting something doesn't necessarily mean something material in a gross sense. It could be something more subtle. Or it could even be something spiritual. So to understand what is our real self-interest, we have to know what is our real self. That is the first point. Now, generally, in broad terms, people identify either with the body, the gross body, or with the mind, subtle body. And both of these identifications are mistaken. Both are mistaken. Because we, the living entity, is neither the gross physical body nor the subtle mental or intellectual body. But our actual identity is as a spirit soul, part and parcel of the supreme soul. We can understand easily that we are not the body, because the body is changing at every moment. When we are born, we have a little baby's body, then we have a child's body, say maybe 9 years old. Rasalila, can you stand up? This is what a 9-year-old body looks like. ten. A beautiful 10-year-old body, I might add. Okay, thank you very much. And then you get a youth body, 16-year-old, 18-year-old. Then you're not in the room to be called upon to stand up. Oh, you are?
Yes.
Judith, dear, I didn't see you. Please stand up. How old are you? 17. This is what a 17-year-old body, and a handsome 17-year-old body, looks like. Then 25. Then after that, we don't embarrass our guests. But I will offer myself when you get to be in your 60s. This is and a pretty poor specimen at that. This is what you get. But the soul within the body is the same soul. And okay, now I'm in a 60-year-old body. And I remember that when I was in a 10-year-old body, I used to run and jump and play. I can't run and jump and play like I did when I was 10 years old. But I remember I used to do it. I'm the same person. And people address me as the same person. But the body, this body, is completely different from the 10-year-old body I had. And babies' bodies, the resemblance is so strained that I think pretty much I could show you pictures of three babies, one of them being me, and you wouldn't be able to tell which was me. Because that body and this body are different. But I'm the same person. So who is that I? That I is the soul. So the soul continues to exist despite the change of body. And so the soul is our actual identity. Not the body and not the mind. The mind also changes. That is also obvious. Our tastes change. When we were 5 years old, we had a certain taste in music. Then when we were 13 years old, we had a different taste. Then 20, 30, 40, and so on. But we're still the same person. That means that we are the soul, not the body or the mind. So our real self-interest isn't for the sake of the body or even the mind, but it's for our real self, which is the soul. There's tremendous frustration and stress in the world because people do not know who they are. They wrongly think that they are the body. And thinking that they are the body, they do pretty much everything for the sake of the body, but because they're not the body, working for the sake of the body does not bring happiness to the self. Recently, I've become aware that there have been a number of studies on the topic of what makes someone happy. It's like people have confronted the fact that they're not happy. They've done everything they thought would make them happy, but they still were not happy. So now psychologists, sociologists, whatever, are conducting studies. What makes someone happy? They're trying to find some correlation between different types of activities and happiness. Because the most commonly believed factors of happiness have turned out not to be correlated to happiness. Of course, the big ones are money. Money's a big one. And studies have found that once you reach a certain level of subsistence, I mean, below that level, yeah, if you get some money, it can improve the quality of your life because you don't go to bed hungry. You know, you don't feel cold at night. But once you have your basic necessities met, the studies have shown that adding more money does not increase your happiness. Yet people have somehow become convinced that they should keep making more money, even though they don't have to survive, and even though having the extra money won't really make them happier, but they still do it. Because they've sort of bought into a system. an illusory system. And the same applies to other other factors. Due to limitations of time, I won't discuss each and every one, but the conclusion is that the things that people think will make them happy later in life turn out not to make them happy. So now there are a lot of studies. What makes people happy? Of course, they're dealing with a very relative, subjective consideration of what happiness is. That's another point. But for the sake of our discussion of the Bhagavad Gita, let us just say that in the beginning, if you make a mistake in terms of what your identity is, then even if you do everything else correctly in terms of that mistaken idea, you'll get further and further from the result you want. It's just like if you're doing a mathematical calculation and you make a mistake in the first step, then even if you perform all the other steps correctly, you may end up getting further and further away from the actual answer or solution. So if we make a mistake in the first step, which is who we are, and if we think we're the body, then even if we do everything else perfectly for the sake of the body, we'll get further and further away from the actual answer or solution to the problems of life, or answer to the question how to find happiness. So the first instruction of the Bhagavad Gita is, you're not the body, you are the soul. And as a soul, you are part and parcel of the Supreme Soul. And therefore, your real self-interest is to serve the Supreme Soul, or Krishna. And therefore, the Bhagavatam says, Nate vidu swarthagatim hi Vishnu. People do not know what their real self-interest is, that their real self-interest is to serve Vishnu or Krishna. Now that follows, if we understand that as spirit souls we're part and parcel of the Supreme Soul, then just like the hand is part and parcel of the body, so the interest of the hand is to serve the body. If the hand wants to enjoy independent of the body, it cannot. The hand is meant to serve the body. For example, if we have some nice sweet balls to eat. Now, the hand is meant to take the food and feed the stomach. And from the food going into the stomach, the nutrition is distributed throughout the body. But if the hand thinks, oh, well, why should I serve the stomach? Why should I do everything for the stomach? I'm gonna enjoy that sweet ball directly. Well, it won't work because the hand is meant to put the food into the mouth so that it goes to the stomach. It's not meant to enjoy the food independent of the stomach. So in the same way, because we're part and parcel of God or Krishna, we are meant to serve Him. And by that process, we will be nourished, we will feel satisfied, we'll feel happy. And on this basis, on the basis of this conviction, one can engage in devotional service or bhakti yoga with determination. I mean, if you're really convinced that something is good for you, then you'll do it. People are doing all sorts of austerities to get material things that they think will make them happy, but unfortunately, in the end, they discover that material things don't make them happy. But they sacrifice for it. They spend years studying, and then they, whatever, start a business or get a job. And for the sake of the business or job, they work hard. Even if they don't feel like going to work, they go to work. Even if they don't particularly feel like meeting a potential customer, but they do it for the sake of the business. So when we're convinced that something will bring us some benefit, we're ready to make sacrifices. Everyone is making sacrifices all the time. But unfortunately, they're making sacrifices for things that in the end don't bring them the happiness they seek. So this dridhavritaha, this determination, of course there are people who don't have much determination even materially. But everyone has some degree of determination, because without some determination you couldn't survive. You couldn't survive. So you have some determination. But what's the result? Okay, you survived. But what is that achievement actually? Because the soul is eternal. The soul is going to live eternally anyway. The credit is that you've kept the body, you kept the soul in this body. That's your credit. Okay. But how much of a credit is that? Because there are millions of species of life. There are ants who eat a grain of sugar. And there are elephants who eat about 80 pounds of food every day. And all those millions of ants, there's so many ants, we're not even conscious of them until we leave some food out, especially sweets. And you can see hundreds of them coming out of nowhere. They were there somewhere. So there are hundreds and thousands and millions and billions of ants. And they're all getting their one grain. And I don't know how many elephants there are left. But there are elephants. And they're getting their 80 pounds. But they're not going to the office or the factory or the shop or the mall. Or going online, but they're getting their necessities of life met. In the Upanishads, it is stated, nityo nityanam chaitanas chaitananam ego yo bahunam vidudati kama Nitya means eternal. So amongst so many plural number of living entities, there's one singular eternal living entity. And Chaitana, Chaitananam, out of so many plural number of conscious living entities, there's one singular conscious living entity, and that one singular eternal conscious living entity is maintaining and fulfilling the necessities of all the plural number. So that one, who we call Krishna, is maintaining all of us, whether in the body of an ant or an elephant or a human being. Now, someone may say, and it is true, that, well, ants are meant to live like that, and elephants are meant to live the way they live, but we need to have houses, we need to have clothing. We have other necessities, and to meet our necessities, we have to work in a different way. Well, that's true. But if we work for God, for Krishna, He will take care of us as we need to be taken care of. If we are doing the work of a Mahatma, broadcasting the glories of the Lord will maintain us. Even in the material world, if you are hired by a company to do their publicity or advertising, the company will pay you. So if we're making publicity for the Supreme Lord, doing advertising, so to speak, for the Supreme Lord, is He not going to maintain us? Certainly He will maintain us. So it's the same sort of point that people are working, but for the wrong purpose, for the wrong master. Which brings me to another point about bowing down. It is mentioned in this verse, bowing down. When Srila Prabhupada first came to the United States, he gave a talk in Seattle in 1968. And one young man said, "I don't want to bow down." Actually, it is a matter of etiquette or culture that one bows down to the spiritual master, bows down to the deity, bows down to any respectable person. So he said, "I don't want to bow down." And Srila Prabhupada replied, "You may not want to bow down, but you are forced to bow down." So it is not a question of not bowing down. It is a question of where to bow down so that you will be happy. When you go to work, in a way, you have to bow down to your boss. When you do sales, you have to bow down to your customers. Customers always right. And Srila Prabhupada said, if you do not voluntarily bow down to Krishna, you'll be forced to bow down to Maya, or the material nature. And bowing down to Maya means that you have to bow down to repeated birth, disease, old age, and death. You may say, oh, I don't want those things. Well, you're forced to accept them, whether you want them or not. So this is our choice, not whether to bow down or not. We are forced to bow down. The question is where to bow down so that we can be happy, even while bowing down. And that is mentioned in this verse, Krishna. There was a musician named Boy George. I say was, I mean maybe he's still around and is a musician. And he met devotees, many musicians have met devotees and been touched by Krishna consciousness. So Boy George was one of them, and he came to Vrindavan, the holy place of Lord Krishna's pastimes on earth. And he stayed at our temple in Vrindavan. And he was very shocked to see so many people coming to the temple and not bowing down to the deities, to the deity form of the Lord. And then he wrote a song, Bow Down, Mister. That was the context. You know, bow down, Mister. Hare Krishna, Hare Ram. So, you can probably understand that what I'm saying about this verse today is that we're doing everything anyway. We are chanting. We're glorifying people. It's getting harder, but we'll find someone to glorify, some political figure, some altruist, some musician, some actor, some actress, some sportsman. We're glorifying people. That when there's an election, people come out and they glorify their candidate. When there's a sports competition, people come out and they root for their team and they glorify their heroes and their team. It's everywhere. Whenever there's awards, film awards, music awards, television awards, They're glorifying. That's a sort of kirtan. A sort of perverted kirtan, but it's a sort of kirtan. So we're doing everything. We're glorifying, we're bowing down, we're endeavoring with determination. But because we have misunderstood who we are and what our self-interest is, we're glorifying the wrong people or the wrong things, endeavoring with determination for the wrong things, bowing down to the wrong people or for the wrong reasons. So we don't really have to change what we're doing that much, but we just have to change the understanding of who we are and what our purpose in life is, and do the same things but for a different cause, for a different purpose. Now, all right, we can understand there's a qualitative difference between glorifying Krishna and whoever, political leader or football player, basketball player, movie actor, movie actress. But what about demigods? In the Vedic tradition, there's such comprehensive knowledge that we learn of many different gradations of living entities. Of course, the human form is special. Human beings have more developed consciousness, so they can actually understand who they are and what the purpose of life is. But there are beings even more developed than the human beings that we know on Earth. There are planets with life more developed than life on Earth. Of course, people are in ignorance. That's a whole other subject. But people are in darkness. They have no idea, even about the material universe. They have no idea what's going on other planets. But without discussing that in more detail now, although we could discuss it, let us just say that, well, we do have to discuss a little, because they're starting from the wrong point. They're starting from matter. They're starting from atoms and molecules. And on the basis of atoms and molecules, they're thinking, oh, the atoms, molecules are combining and becoming bigger units, and then, you know, just sort of chance, random, you get, anyway, it's pretty absurd, but that's what they think. That we've all happened by chance. Pretty absurd. So in the same way they think these planets have happened by chance, and it's by chance that the ingredients for life exist in just the right combination and proportion on Earth to sustain life, but the other planets, they're just lumps of matter whirling in space. There's nothing there. So, according to Vedic knowledge, there are beings on those planets, and some of those beings are more advanced than the human beings on Earth. Much more advanced. And they are called devas. Devas, devatas, or in English you could say demigods. And among them, some are very prominent and powerful. Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, Surya, the sun god, Surya Namaskar, Durga, But they are not the supreme Godhead. They are expansions of the supreme Godhead, just like we are. But they're not the supreme Godhead. So it is not in our interest, particularly, to serve them. It is not in our interest, particularly, to glorify them. It is not in our interest, particularly, to bow down to them. It is not in our interest, particularly, to worship them. Lord Shiva is in a little different category, but still, he's not the supreme Godhead. And the other demigods, even Lord Brahma, is a living entity, a soul like we are. And it's a post. Any one of us could become Lord Brahma if we're qualified. So this verse instructs us, Krishna speaking the verse, satatam kirtayantamam, always chanting my glories. Now, this is the statement of Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, which is accepted as authority in Vedic civilization. It is the textbook of yoga. Everyone in Vedic civilization accepts the authority of the Bhagavad Gita, and this is what the Bhagavad Gita tells us. But that does not mean, although it's clear in the Bhagavad Gita, it doesn't mean people don't have misconceptions. And they do. They abound. Once, when we were in Bombay, a quite affluent, prominent Hindu, visited Srila Prabhupada, and he asked Srila Prabhupada that India is a land of Mahatmas, but in spite of the presence of so many Mahatmas, there are still so many problems in India. Why is that? And Srila Prabhupada replied, the reason you have so many problems in India is that you do not know who is a Mahatma and who is not a Mahatma. So this sort of hazy, fuzzy idea, like anyone, whatever, who has a long beard and hair, whatever, wears robes, is a Mahatma. Or that any deity whose picture you can buy in an Indian import store is the supreme personality of Godhead. It is just not the case. Is just not true. And you will not get the same result by following a so-called Mahatma or an actual Mahatma as defined here. You won't get the same result by glorifying a demigod or worshipping a demigod as you will by worshipping the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You just won't. The Bhagavad Gita says, Those who worship the ghosts and spirits will go to the ghosts and spirits. Those who worship the demigods will go to the demigods. And those who worship me will come to me. It's just so obvious. You can't buy a ticket to Bombay and think you'll get off in Calcutta. The ticket won't take you to Calcutta. The ticket will take you to Bombay. So if you're worshiping Krishna, truly, you know, as described in this verse, that's your ticket to Krishna. But if you're worshiping someone else, that's your ticket to somewhere else. It's logical. It's obvious. So we have that task of presenting the Bhagavad Gita as it is. Srila Prabhupada titled his translation of the Bhagavad Gita, "The Bhagavad Gita as it is," meaning as Krishna spoke it, and Krishna's the speaker, the teacher, and as Arjuna understood it. Arjuna's the student, exemplary student. And how did Arjuna accept it? He accepted Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Param Brahma, Param Dhamma, Pavitram, Paramam Bhavan. And he accepted everything that Krishna said as true. He said, Sarvam etadrite mande, that I accept as true, in toto, everything that you have said. And that's how we have to accept the Bhagavad Gita, and that's how we have to present it to get the actual benefit. So today is a very auspicious day. It is the appearance day of Srila Madhvacharya. Srila Madhvacharya is one of the four main acharyas of India. And this verse and purport are very appropriate, because his philosophy is called Dvaita. In fact, you can see pictures of him like this. This is his symbol. Because sometimes people do that to us, but I think it's the peace symbol in their lexicon. But Madhvacharya, he made this his symbol, meaning two. It's not all one. It's not that the individual soul and the supreme soul are one, but two. So this is like his mudra, and there are basically four sampradayas, approved lines of disciplic succession or parampara mentioned in scripture. There's the Rudra Sampradaya, which begins with Shiva. There's the Brahma Sampradaya that begins with Brahma. There's the Kumara Sampradaya that begins with the four Kumaras. And there's the Sri Sampradaya that begins with Lakshmi. And each has a prominent acharya on earth, you know, within written history. So Madhvacharya, he is the acharya in the Brahma Sampradaya. Tomorrow is Ramanujacharya's appearance day. He's the acharya in the Sri Sampradaya. And then there's Nimbarkacharya and Vishnu Swami in the Rudra Sampradaya and Kumar Sampradaya. But it is described that Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the modern founder of the Hare Krishna movement 500 years ago, he took two elements from each of the four sampradayas. And he, you could say, distilled the quintessence of each. And on this point of dualism, like Madhvacharya's Dvaita, then Ramanujacharya's Vishishta Dvaita, they're different variations. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy is Achintya Ved Aved Tattva. This is extraordinary. Achintya means inconceivable. And Ved and Aved means different and not different, or one and different. So you can think that an apple and an orange are different, because one's an apple and one's an orange. In fact, there's some expression, don't compare apples and apples and oranges. Apples and oranges. But then again, you could think, well, but they're both fruit, so they're the same. But it's very hard at the exact same moment to think of them being the same and different. You can see, well, yeah, they're the same. They're both fruits, but they're different. One's an apple and one's an orange. So this Achintya Veda Veda Tattva, the reason it's inconceivable is because you cannot simultaneously conceive of something being the same and different at the same time. So this is inconceivable simultaneous oneness and difference. We are one with the Lord in quality. We have the same qualities, nityo nityanam, chaitanas chaitananam, but we're different in quantity because the Lord is infinite and we are infinitesimal. Now, for us to have a relationship with someone, we have to have something in common. If we don't have anything in common, if we're not in the same category, at least in some respect, we can't have a relationship. So because we're one in quality with Krishna, we can have a relationship with him. But because we're different in quantity, he's infinite, or he's the whole, and we are infinitesimal, we're the part. So that defines the relationship as one of servant and master. And when we are in our constitutional position as eternal servants of Krishna, we're happy. That is liberation. That is liberation. Real liberation is not merging and becoming one with the impersonal Brahma-jyoti light. That's there. We don't deny it. That is there. But there's no ananda. There's no bliss in that. And it's also not permanent. One would hope that it would be permanent. First of all, it's almost impossible to achieve that impersonal merging. It's practically impossible. And in this day and age, really, next to impossible. But it's the same sort of irony that what you think is going to make you happy doesn't make you happy. Because even if you merge and become one with the impersonal Brahma Jyoti, you don't really become happy. You get relief from the miseries of the material world. That's there, like nirvana, cessation of material miseries. But there's nothing positive. There's no positive relationship of love that will bring happiness. Everyone wants love. I mean, if you imagine yourself as the richest person in the world, having everything you could possibly want, but you were all alone, you had no one to share it with, you wouldn't be happy. No one would want to be in that position. So being in the impersonal Brahman, merging, you don't actually merge, but you sort of, it's described like molecules of sunshine. And anyway, that's another thing. But so you're like a spiritual molecule, and you merge into this vast expanse of light, spiritual light, which is permeated by or pervaded by other spiritual molecules. And you temporarily suspend your individual existence. But eventually, guess what? You feel lonely. Even in the impersonal Brahma Jyoti, you feel lonely. And you feel restless. It's like people go on a cruise, you know, they want to get away from it all. They go on a cruise. And for a while it's great, you know, leave everything back on the shore, all the problems, all the people and everything else. And it's great, you're just out in the ocean, it's fantastic. But after a while, you get bored. You're seeing the same ocean, same waves all the time. So the Brahma Jyoti is like, it's great, you get away from it all. But it's all the same. And there's no one else to interact with. So the Bhagavatam says, patanti adas, that even if you think that you've reached that highest stage of impersonal liberation, patanti adas, you fall down again because there's no activity. There's no loving reciprocation. So you fall down again. So real happiness is in a loving relationship with the supreme lovable person, Krishna. And one who understands that is a Mahatma. And as Srila Prabhupada says in the concluding paragraph, it doesn't matter where you are, it doesn't matter what your station in life is, whether you're a celibate student or a householder or a renunciate. It doesn't matter what station of life you're in, it doesn't matter where you're born or where you live, but if you take up the process described in this verse with determination, you can become a Mahatma. And the result of becoming a Mahatma is that you will be reinstated in your original position as eternal servant of Krishna, God, and you will live an eternal life of bliss and knowledge in his association. And that becomes our determination. So, Hare Krishna, thank you for your patience. I neglected to ask when the talk was supposed to end, but Tatikshava Karunika Prabhu gave me the blessing that whatever I would do would be just fine. So depending on his blessings, I spoke some words. But I do feel it would be good if any of you have any questions. You can ask them now or later, but now is we're in the now, so. Yes.
What are the two points that Lord Chaitanya took from each of the four Vaishnavas and Vrindavanis to formulate this?
Well, that would be a long discussion, but that is described, by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur in his Navadvipa Parikrama book.
Navadvipa.
Yeah. Or I can send you an email, but I think that would be a little bit of an esoteric question, and it would take a bit of an explanation.
Okay.
Yes.
A Mahatma is someone who is always glorifying Krishna.
Yeah. Well, that is really the best question you or anyone could have asked. How do we apply this practically? Actually, you find the same instruction in the Shikshastika by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Kirtaniya Sadahari, to always be engaged in chanting the holy name or in glorifying Hari or Krishna. So there are three ways of looking at this. The first is that, as you mentioned, while you're working, you can still think of Krishna. You can be chanting, either vocally or mentally. Now you can say, well, you know, that's not fair. You know, I'm at work and I'm thinking about Krishna. But everyone is always thinking of different things. You know, even, you know, Barack Obama or Steve Jobs or, you know, the captain of the football team. He's not always thinking of, he's thinking, you know, I'm hungry. Oh, I hope I didn't. He's thinking, I'm hungry, when am I going to get to eat, you know? Or he's thinking, you know, he's thinking of his wife at home, or thinking of his children, or thinking of his parents. So people's minds are wandering all the time, you know, from the top, from the president or CEO on down. So if their minds are wandering to, you know, their wife, their children, their parents, their what they're going to do on the weekend, what they're going to do for their holidays, what they're going to eat when they get home. So what's the problem if your mind wanders to Krishna? Everyone's mind is going here and there and everywhere anyway. So yes, you can think of Krishna in your mind. You can chant in your mind. The other thing is that if your goal is Krishna, you know, to be Krishna conscious, but you need to work because you need to keep your body and soul together and live in a situation that will enable you to prosecute Krishna consciousness. So That's also common. When people are working, they're also thinking, what am I going to do with the money? You know, I'm going to do this. So you're thinking, well, I'm going to maintain my household so I can chant, I can read the Bhagavad Gita, I can buy vegetarian food that I can offer to Krishna and take the remnants as prasad. Or if there's some extra, you can use it, to buy books to distribute, or to buy flowers for the deities, or go to India on pilgrimage, or yes, but. The main thing is to be sincere about it. And if you're sincere, then that time that you put in to work, to keep your body and soul together, to engage in Krishna consciousness, is part of the same process. It's not against the principle of Kirtaniya Sadahari. But while you're doing it, you can still be chanting. You can still be chanting. So, yes, we do. We have to take rest at night. We have to brush our teeth. We have to bathe. We have to get dressed. But if the purpose of it all, ultimately, is to serve Krishna and please Krishna and realize our eternal relationship with Krishna, then the minimum that we need to do to keep the body and soul together and survive in the world is not against the principle of satatam kirtayantamam or kirtaniya sadahari.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
This is in reference to we are not the body. When the body feels the pain and the body becomes old, how does the soul feel? Does it feel sad? Like if you pinch my body, does the soul feel angry? And the second question is, did the soul choose the body or the body chose the soul? And how this body, mind and soul react? And one more question, what is the difference between Atma, Mahatma, Purnatma and Paramatma?
What about Atma, Atma? All right. We start with the soul, the individual soul. The individual soul is part and parcel of the Supreme Soul. The individual soul is a person. We are persons. The body is not a person. That's one of the defects with the impersonal philosophy. They think that the spirit is impersonal, and because it has accepted a body, it's become a person, but when it's liberated, then it becomes imperson again. But that is foolishness. It's foolishness. When the soul leaves the body, the eyes, the nose, the ears, the tongue, the arms, the legs, the belly, everything is there, but there's no person there. The person is the soul. The body's just a machine. The body's not a person. The body's just a machine. The soul is the person who makes the body work. It's just like a criminal is put in prison. He's a person in prison, and when he's released, when he's liberated from the bondage of prison life, he's still a person. But he's not a prisoner. He's a free person. But what does that mean, a free person? It means that he's given freedom on the understanding that he will voluntarily abide by the laws of the state. If he violates the laws of the state, he again becomes a criminal and he's again punished. So we're persons in the state of bondage and we're persons in the state of liberation. It's just that when we're liberated, we're free. We're not punished by the material nature, which repeated birth, disease, old age, and death. Now, when the living entity turns away from Krishna and comes into the material world, he gets a material body and suffers. Now, does the soul suffer? That's your question. Well, the soul never actually mixes with matter. The soul is always aloof from matter. But the consciousness, it's described that the soul is in the region of the heart. But the consciousness spreads throughout the body. So, if someone steps on your toe, you feel it. Someone pinches you, or you pinch yourself, you feel it. Because the consciousness is pervading the body. It's like the sun is localized, but the sunshine pervades the universe, or the solar system. So because the consciousness is pervading the body, you feel pains and pleasures. But your experience of pains and pleasures is limited to your body, within your body. That's the jivatma, the individual soul. But the paramatma is in the heart of every living entity. And he knows the pains and pleasures in every body. Like, you know what you're thinking, but you don't know what I'm thinking. Or what he's thinking, or what she's thinking. Because your awareness is limited to your body. But Krishna, the super soul, he knows exactly whatever pain and pleasure every single person in this room and outside of this room and in any and every species of life is experiencing. He knows what they're thinking. He knows what they're feeling. He knows what they're desiring. So that's the paramatma. That's the localized super soul within the heart of every living entity. And then there's the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna. In the spiritual world, that's our goal, to join Krishna in his loving service in the spiritual world. Mahatma is a jivatma, but his consciousness has been expanded. So he sees everyone equally. He sees everyone as spirit, soul, part and parcel of Krishna. That's Mahatma. And then there's Duratma. You forgot about Duratma. Duratma is the opposite of Mahatma. It's like cripple-minded, just thinking of myself, you know, myself, or, you know, me and my girl, or me and my family, or, you know, limited. But Mahatma is broad-minded. He sees all living entities as part and parcel of Krishna. So was there something else? Okay. Yes. Yes. It's not a matter of just armchair discussion. It's something that you really have to understand. And if you really understand it, your life will change. If you understand even just that you're not the body, your life will change. Because that, even if theoretically we know we're not the body, but we're really not, we don't really understand it. And therefore we act so much on the basis of the body. So much on the basis of the body. This is a good question. I will have to qualify what I said to answer your question. There's material advancement and spiritual advancement. And just like on earth, someone can be materially developed and spiritually advanced, or materially developed and mean, you know. And someone can be poor and be spiritually advanced, or someone can be poor and be mean. So the same thing exists on the higher level. The devas that I refer to, by definition, are pious and godly. But even amongst the devas, there's different degrees of advancement, different degrees of living conditions. Different standards of living conditions. So, roughly speaking, the Vedic literature has described 14 levels of planetary systems. And we are in the middle range. The Earth is in the middle range, but on the lower end of the middle range. So, the above the earth, the pious people, they're more pious, they're more advanced, they're more intelligent. Everything is of a higher standard. The music, the art, the dance, the philosophy, everything is higher. But they're still not completely pure. So basically they want the people on earth to become pious and godly, you know. But there are also people who are more materially advanced than people on earth who are not all benevolent. Some are malevolent. But because of being Duratmas, they don't really even care that much about us. They're mean people, but we're like too insignificant. So they don't even really think about us. They're more concerned with their rivals on their level. We're not rivals. We're too insignificant. But those who are godly, they think of us because they're broad-minded, they're Mahatmas, and they want us to progress and become godly. And then the higher you get, you know, the more spiritually evolved they are. And on that very high level, you don't get that malevolent type of materially advanced person. They just can't reach that high. So they can help us, these higher beings, they can help us.
Do they want to?
Sorry?
Do they want to help us?
Well, what I was about to say would answer that as well. The one person we really need to please and win the favor of is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So these godly people on higher planets with more evolved consciousness, they're also devotees of Krishna. And as a devotee of Krishna, they, by definition, have the same, identify with his purposes. And his purpose is to get us all back home, back to Godhead. So because they're devotees, they share in that interest of Krishna's. But the higher they are, means the more pure they are, the more they identify exclusively with Krishna's purpose and have less personal interest mixed with it. You get what I mean?
I do.
Yeah. But when you get to 100% pure, then other than rare souls who are in the material world only for Krishna's work, those souls are with Krishna in the spiritual world. And they are 100% our well-wishers and benefactors. And they're the ones that we should really be approaching for help and guidance and mercy. Not even the higher ones in the material world. Well, I was referring to the ones with Krishna in the spiritual world. But the ones on earth, they can help us in a more immediate sense. Like in, there's a word Bhagavat. The word Bhagavan, God, Bhagavat is the same root. So Bhagavat can refer to a book called the Bhagavat Purana or Srimad Bhagavatam, which is about the Lord and his devotees. The Lord is never alone, he's always with his devotees. But there's also the person Bhagavat, and an advanced devotee is called a Bhagavat. And there's a verse in the book Bhagavat, Srimad Bhagavatam, that says that by hearing the book Bhagavat or by serving, well, it really uses the word serving, by serving the book Bhagavat or the person Bhagavat, one gets the same result. And all the inauspicious things within the heart become cleansed, and one becomes fixed in the service of the Lord. So once a disciple asked Srila Prabhupada, well, we say that the two are the same, and by serving the two, one gets the same result, but is one better than the other? And then Srila Prabhupada said, the person Bhagavat is better. And then the disciple asked why, and he said, because the person Bhagavat can catch you by the ear. So, even though the residents of the spiritual world are certainly, I mean, we should always think of them and pray to them, pray for their mercy and pray for their guidance. But the association of devotees on earth is very important. That's because they can correct us in practical ways. They can encourage us. And that's, we need that. In fact, one of the factors that these studies found that correlated with happiness, I mean in their own meager way, was having regular association. So we have that, but our purpose is noble. You know, anyone will feel better, whatever they are, if they have company. But, you know, that company could lead them all to hell, really. I mean, It's a sort of illusory type of happiness. But this association is ennobling and uplifting. That's most important. Thank you for your question. Just on that subject of association, a 20-year-old Hispanic girl in Santa Barbara, where I have a base, tragically died, in a swimming pool. And we knew her mother and sister and other family members, so we went to the funeral. And it was all conducted in Spanish, Catholic. But at a certain point, the whatever priest or preacher started to speak in English, and he was addressing the young people, and he said that you have to be very careful who you choose as your friends. He said, first, the friend should be someone that you can open your heart to, who will, be with you through thick and thin. Then he said that you should only choose friends that will encourage you to go in the right direction, not in the wrong direction. And he said, if you choose someone as a friend who tells you to do something you shouldn't do, I don't remember exactly, but he was alluding to drugs and those things. He said that he's not a real friend. He's not a real friend. Don't choose that person as a friend. And another point he said was that you should respect and obey your parents. Don't think that because you know English better than they do, or you know the ways of America better than they do, that you don't have to respect them or listen to them. And if your friend encourages you, oh, they don't know, they don't know English, what do they know? They don't know how things work in America. You don't need to even listen to them. You just do what you want. He's not a real friend. So you have to really be careful. A man is known by the company he keeps. But more than that, you become like the company you keep. So if you associate with godly people, serious devotees, you become a serious devotee. All right, well, thank you for your patience, attentive hearing, intelligent questioning, inquiry. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Hare Krishna Mahamantra ki jai.